On the 7th of October 1992, at just 7 years of age, Nikki Allen would be subjected to a violent and brutal assault where she would eventually be murdered after being lured to a derelict building by a killer. Initially, an innocent man would be falsely accused, having catastrophic impact on his life. And it took over 30 years for her actual killer to be brought to justice. This is the devastating case of the murder of Nikki Allen.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's look at this case. And let's start with the most important person within it, which is Nikki Allen. So Nikki Allen was a 7-year-old girl from Sunderland. It's close to where my own husband was born. And when I tell you the people of Sunderland are just a really special group of humans, genuinely, I feel that they are one of the friendliest communities that you could ever meet. You always feel such a sense of being embraced by people from that environment and area. And it's a true bedrock of community, even now. In today's age where I think we're more isolated, Sunderland embodies that. Nikki Allen was growing up there as a 7-year-old, and she was a daughter to Sharon Henderson and David Allen, who were devoted parents. She lived in the Weir Garth flats on the docks in the east end of Sunderland, and that was a really community-orientated place. Financially, people weren't in economically privileged positions there, but often the more economically privileged you are, the more isolated you become in your life. You buy bigger homes and you separate from your neighbours. Whereas when there's quite an intensity in your environment because you're living on top of each other in flats, there often lends itself to a group of people who get to know one another and care for one another and operate as a wider family. And certainly the Weir Garth flats at the time represented this. This little girl who was absolutely gorgeous, she's being brought with her mother, her stepfather, her sister, and her two half-sisters. And people who knew Nikki said that she was really bright, she was really sparky, she was a happy child, and the picture that I put up of her, you will note that smile. Everybody said she had a beautiful smile, and indeed she did. And whilst you can never always tell what's going on behind a child's appearance, because darkness infects children's lives, and they can put a mask on and appear okay. But when you look at Nikki's face, it's just one of innocence and joy. And she's truly happy, you can see that. Apparently she was known as always a mammy's girl, so her and her mommy were really close. She's very much loved. She was very bubbly apparently, and the family themselves were known to the neighbours in the flats, and they were well liked by the neighbours in the flats. So it was a place where people looked after each other. And it's important because it was also a place where people noticed things happening. And that's key, because when we're looking for suspects, for example, we need people's perspectives of situations playing out to garner the information that creates the breadcrumb trail required to find perpetrators. Now, when her mother talks about what life was like bringing Nikki up and the family that she lived with, she says that life was economically not easy. They didn't have much, but that never affected the happiness that they shared. They'd go shopping together, they'd have picnics together, they'd go to the fair and have days out, and that they would literally cherish the fun that they would share. No matter how they struggled financially, they would really make the most of spending time together. And I can look back at my time as the single mum when I genuinely didn't have any money to do anything. I struggled to even keep a roof over our heads, but making those picnics and taking them to the park genuinely felt like I was the wealthiest woman in the world because I had my two little boys. And I totally get that money, whilst it's lovely to have, and certainly whilst it makes the financial experience in life far easier, the truth is that when you have little, the bits that you do have, you tend to appreciate to such a greater extent. So I totally relate to Nikki's mum on that point. Sadly, things changed massively, dramatically, and eternally for the family. So Nikki, this gorgeous little girl, goes missing. So on the 7th of October 1992, she was basically last seen playing outside the block of flats where she lived. Before she went missing, she'd been to her grandparents with her mother, but like kids do, Nikki decided that she wanted to return home early, and so she began the walk back to her house. Now, bear in mind, it's only 150 yards down the stairwell and across the corridor. We're not talking about a long distance, and she's seven, and this is familiar territory, and the neighbours know her well. So to all intents and purposes, for a parent, making the decision to allow the child to go a little bit ahead, and that's all that was happening. Her mother was following her. It didn't seem to be something that would bring a level of concern, so her mother lets her do that. But then when her mother comes back 10 minutes later, that's all the time frame was in between when Nikki set off and her mother noticing that she's not there. Nikki is nowhere to be seen. Now her mother straight away is worried. She has that feeling of dread in the pit of her stomach because this is not the way that Nikki acts. So she starts to knock on doors. She starts to ask people, have you seen my daughter? And it turns out that Nikki had been seen at approximately 9:45 outside the Boar's Head pub. Now at this point, her mum starts to get more and more increasingly worried, and other people start shouting Nikki's name because they can see that things seem to be taking a sinister turn, and they're deeply concerned about this little girl. Kids don't go missing in that area. Everyone knows each other. When they're talking to people about who's seen Nikki and if people have seen Nikki, it transpires that she'd last been seen sitting on a wall, and she'd actually told a witness who'd had a conversation with her that she was waiting for her mum. And again, that's indicative of the kind of child we're talking about. She's not the type of kid to go anywhere by herself. She'd had permission to walk that little way home, and then she sat literally waiting for her mother. But the next witness that's spoken to tells them that they saw Nikki, but she was seen skipping after a man. And that is just absolutely breathtakingly horrific for any parent to hear. I appreciate that there are mostly innocent, lovely men in this world, but why on earth would a little girl be skipping after an adult male? It just bodes of something sinister without a shadow of a doubt. They get CCTV and it shows the seven-year-old being led away by a man. She's last seen wearing a purple coat, a green t-shirt and black leggings. That was the outfit that would be the final outfit she was ever noted wearing. Now immediately there was a sense of urgency regarding her disappearance. They get helicopters out, a search party sent out, over 100 police and neighbours were out searching for Nikki, because my God, the people in that area, they rallied like no one else. They were all invested in bringing that little girl home. The community came together in this desperate bid to try to find Nikki. Volunteers were searching throughout the night, and the morning after, a horrible discovery is made because they find that little girl's shoes and coat. And that in itself just triggers the deep, dark realization that something truly awful is likely to have happened to this child. Because kids don't take off their shoes and their coats. That's not something a seven-year-old would do, particularly in the dark and cold of the night. And for those volunteers who find them, they anticipate that the news that they're going to get in the end is not going to be positive. They keep searching, and then unfortunately, a teenager discovers Nikki's body. It's heavily bloodstained, lying in a pool of her own blood in the basement of a disused exchange building. At that moment, the teenager who finds the body runs out, tells the other volunteers, and of course to inform the authorities. And it's the worst news possible. Children are rarely murdered, thank God, in our society. But when they are murdered, it tends to be by parents or people who are known to the family as in close members of friendship groups. But stranger murder, well, that's very, very rare. So they have to manage the concepts as a community that there is a murderer lurking within their local area. They figure out that Nikki had been lured to wasteland next to the River Weir, and this is where she'd likely been struck on the head. That had caused bleeding. They then believe that Nikki would have been forced through an opening in a boarded up window in the old exchange building, and that she would have been hit over the head with a brick at that point. And bear in mind, this exchange building would have been pitch black. It was really difficult to get in. There were small holes that she could be pushed through essentially, And you have to remember that that would have meant the perpetrator was behind her, would have needed to push her into this building. It would have been pitch black. She's seven. She's injured. She's terrified. And now she's in the pitch black, aware that this predator is coming for her. It's incomprehensible as a mother for me to even begin to conceive of the horror that that little girl would have endured and the horror that her family would have to endure knowing what I've just told you. But aside from those blunt force trauma injuries to her head, including an injury that literally shattered a skull, she was also stabbed 37 times in the chest and abdomen. Now that's overkill. And people can say, well, maybe this is an individual who didn't want to be recognised by her, so decided that there was no other option but to murder her. No. Don't buy into that for 1 minute. There is no expert in this land who can tell me that somebody who stabs a child 37 times was just trying to make sure they were dead. Not a chance. To stab a child 37 times, it's about rage. It's about pure, innate aggression, murderous intent. It's sexually sadistic, I would imagine, as well, because there'll be a pleasure in doing it. It's a little seven-year-old girl's body. To stab her 37 times is to grotesquely disfigure her, to annihilate her in so many different ways, to humiliate her corpse to some degree because of the decimation that involves, and to knowingly and willingly do that all the while. So I won't buy into the idea that this is an individual who maybe hurt her or sexually molested her and then thought better of allowing her to go free for the fear that she would identify him. This is somebody who callously wished to kill. Make no bones about that. And that might not be how this is portrayed in court, but without a shadow of a doubt, that's what happened. This is somebody.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Who wanted that little girl dead. They were waiting for an opportunity to kill a child and they took it. After that heinous crime is played out, Nick is dragged down a flight of stairs by her ankles, her head banging on every single step as she's dragged by those ankles, and they dump her in the old exchange building basement. A little seven-year-old girl. Yes, it's now her body, but she's been thrown away like rubbish. And the building was literally so close to her house. It was just a few hundred yards away. And now she's broken and killed in the most horrific of form and fashion. And her mother is so unaware at this point of how close her beautiful little girl is to her. When you consider what I've just described, it's evident that we're dealing with a perpetrator of the highest level, likely a sexual sadist, certainly somebody who has predilections for children. When the community discover that that little girl has been killed, it just breaks the community. There's so many floral tributes that get left in front of the building where a body's found because people are good on the whole and people care desperately for children. And it just decimates the way that people feel about the safety of their environment. Nikki's body, that had been so brutally aggressed, it had to be identified by her grandfather. And I cannot imagine how that stained his conscience and traumatized him. I will imagine that he's lived with that moment for the rest of his natural life, living it again, reliving it again and again and again, and then reliving it further, because it is something so outside of the ordinary. It's so extraordinarily grotesque to actually have to do that, and so desperately sad. And to be a grandfather, a male, and to wish to protect your children and your grandchildren at any length, to not be able to do that, that must just be something that is haunting And on top of that, she had been at his house before. And so he had this experience of this beautiful little girl who was so alive, so full of potential, full of hope, full of mischief, full of magic, full of smiles. And now she's on a cold slab, absolutely decimated by some horrific child predator. When they did Nikki's post-mortem, it revealed that the blunt force trauma to her head was likely to have been the thing that knocked her unconscious, and that would have at least mercifully meant that when she was stabbed 37 times, she might not have been aware of it. They believe that Nikki was killed at around 10 p.m. on the 7th of October because a witness actually heard screams at this time. Now, I have to say, personally, if I heard a child screaming, you can bet your bottom dollar I would be investigating it, but I also know that a lot of people just think it will be something that isn't sinister. Personally, you know what I say, risk offending, risk taking a chance, risk going and investigating something, because the consequences of doing that is you might find out it is somebody just having fun, but you also might find out that it's somebody in dire need. But the witness hears those screams, so they kind of have an understanding of where it's likely to have happened and when it's likely to have happened. Following her murder, police start getting some composite sketches out, and they get an artist sketch of the man who's last seen with Nikki. Now, police had a list of more than 100 men who were linked to the drawing, and we have to appreciate that's a lot of work. For every single man that's identified as a potential suspect, they have to rule that person out. And on a positive note, it's brilliant when the public are bringing forth ideas about the potential identity of a suspect, but also when it's wrong, it means that that's another stone that's turned but isn't actually discovered to be linked to the murder, which takes time and can also mean that there is more distance being placed between the event of the murder and the discovery of the perpetrator, which equally means that the perpetrator can put some distance between themselves and the crime, or create stories, false alibis, and so on and so forth. Every day is key in a murder investigation. Now, like with most child murders, when a kid dies in this horrific way, often the community around that child starts to, shall we say, become suspicious, particularly of the people who love that child and look after that child. And the reason for that is psychologically we want to believe that our children are safe. So we think, well, it would never happen to our child because we're better parents, we're kinder parents, we're more responsible parents, and so on and so forth. And to separate yourself from the ultimate reality that it could happen to you and your child, you start to forge these pictures and stories around what may have played out as opposed to what actually played out. So for poor Nikki's family, who are absolutely devastated by her loss, these rumours start floating around that Nikki has been neglected, that she'd been left to walk the streets alone, that she was begging outside the pub the night that she got murdered. All these are absolute lies. But these fuel further agony to this astonishingly painful time. Her mum was actually interviewed quite a few times, and oh, when you're watching her, she is shaking. She's in such a distressed state. She's talking about how she believes that her daughter must have known a killer, because she knows her child. Her child isn't going to go off with a stranger. Her child, as far as she is concerned, understood safe people and unsafe people. And if there is somebody familiar to you as a child and you've seen an adult around you regularly, there is a strong possibility that when they ask you to do something with them, you're a kid. And when you're a kid, there's this rule, you do what adults say. We bring children up to do that. And people can't get this around their heads, because they believe that their child will understand stranger danger. They don't understand the spectrum of stranger danger. So we'll tell children often that if somebody asks them to go with them, say no. And even when we've tested this in public and research psychologically, even children who don't know a person who's an adult, if that adult goes up to them, because they're conditioned to behave in a certain way around adults, they will often take the hand of that person. Not all will, but many will. And it's not because your child is stupid, and it's not because they haven't listened to you talk to them about stranger danger. It's because psychologically they are hardwired by the way that we bring them up to believe that adults know best. If an adult tells you to do something, do it, because at school, that happens at nursery, that happens in life, they're told be respectful and so on and so forth. So they've got this inbuilt sense to act in accordance with what an adult suggests. But then add to that that this person may be a stranger to some degree, as in they're not within their circle of trust as far as the family is concerned, but that child has regularly seen them, maybe said hello to them, maybe said you as a person saying hello to them. And then that person says, come with me. Well, are they a stranger? Or are they just an adult telling them to go with them? Which means the child is in a difficult scenario, because having the power to say no to an adult is difficult. So her mother, I think, is absolutely correct. It's not that it's necessarily somebody who is really close to Nikki. It's just somebody that has been seen in the local area that Nikki's had some kind of contact with, and therefore has a familiarity that gives her a bias of safety about them. And that's so sad, because that's what these predators do. They know how to manipulate. They know how to coerce, and they do it really effectively. Nikki's death left an enormous hole in her family and a community, and obviously that hole remains today, particularly with regards to her family. And they were desperate for answers. So when the police start investigating the murder, and they are desperate to bring this person to justice, because firstly, there is somebody who's got the capacity to kill on the loose, so they start doing what we would consider is quite a thorough investigation. They do house-to-house inquiries. They, like Nikki's mum feels, believe that she was killed by someone that she knew. They don't feel that she was forced to go with the perpetrator, but they feel that she was coerced, she was lured away. It's about a week after Nikki's murder. They have a suspect, George Herron. They bring him in for questioning. Now, Herron fits the profile to some degree. He's a neighbour of Nikki's, so he's familiar. He's 24 at the time. Also, I guess what went against him a little bit is he's described as an oddball and a Doctor Who fan. It does worry me a little bit that people think that you're an oddball potentially if you're a Doctor Who fan, because I was a massive Doctor Who fan as a child, but also when my own kids were growing up. Matt Smith, Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant being my particular favourites. I don't think that makes me weird. I just think that makes me somebody who believes in sci-fi stuff. I say believes, I don't actually mean that I believe in sci-fi stuff. You know what I'm doing and saying. I like the area. It was evocative for me and it was child-friendly. I'm just saying, don't look at me as if I could be a terrible person because I like Doctor Who. But this is enough to make people suspect that he had the potential to do things that are malevolent. Now, at first, Herron actually denied fully knowing who Nikki was. But unfortunately for him, other witnesses said that they'd actually seen him with her. And then he did down the line admit that he did know her. And that's the problem. If you are asked by the police about a particular situation unfolding and you withhold information, you're going to look like a liar. And if you're looking like a liar, they're going to wonder why. If you've done nothing wrong, you certainly don't need to be making things up to protect yourself, because no one is coming for an innocent person. Or is that actually always the case? Because if I'm really honest, we've seen many times in history in the UK, and certainly in other places in the world, where they decide that a suspect is the perpetrator and then they will make the evidence fit the crime. So even though he's ridiculous denying that he doesn't actually know Nikki, and that certainly puts him into a pivotal position where they're going to look at him and think, you did this, it could well be that he's concerned that they might want to pin guilt on him, and he's deeply concerned about what that would mean for his future. But it's a stupid thing to do. Turns out the reason that he would have known her is that Nikki had played with Herron's nephew, and he'd also offered her sweets. Now, back at the time when Nikki went missing and was ultimately killed, there was a lot of advertising campaigns around the fact that children shouldn't accept sweets of strangers and so on and so forth. So now we're forming a picture of what the perfect perpetrator appears like. Also, the blade of a knife in his house did match the stab wounds. That's deeply worrying, isn't it? Because that's the murder weapon. And they also found blood splatters on Herron's shoe and other clothing. So understandably, that's another thing that seems quite powerful and incriminating. His sister, she told the police that on the 7th of August, Heron had actually gone to the bathroom and uncharacteristically, he'd spent a while washing himself and his clothes. And four separate witnesses saw a man at the Boar's Head and Clarendon public houses fitting his description. So I would say the police have got an absolute reason to go ahead and to arrest him. He's lied about knowing this child. He's been implicated to some degree regarding the fact that there's a weapon he could have used that fits the injuries. And on top of that, he's in a situation where his own sister is to some degree a little bit concerned about the possibility of him being involved because she's described how uncharacteristically he's cleaning himself. So at this point, George Heron gets arrested by the police for Nicky's murder. And the local community breathe a sigh of relief because all they want is that person banged to rights, arrested, absolutely incarcerated, and hopefully will never walk the streets again. So after Heron's arrested, he's then subject to 3 days of very intense police questioning. Now that is a lot, and it can break you down. And what we know when people are interrogated is that they can at times state claim to having committed a crime to just end what's happening. Particularly with reference to cases that I've read about both in the UK and the States where this kind of interrogation has occurred. Totally innocent people have got to a point where the police will either promise them that it will all be over and they can go home if they just tell them that they're guilty and they say they're guilty and then that's their fate sealed. Or alternatively, the person becomes so confused, disorientated and fearful that in the end they just give the investigators what they want to just end the emotional pain, the emotional trauma of dealing with that situation. So during this period, at the end of that 120 hours, he apparently makes a supposed confession. And the police at this point are really confident of his conviction and they want to bring him to justice because they believe that he's guilty of murdering this gorgeous little girl. So he's later tried for her murder in 1993 at Leeds Crown Court. The reason they did it at Leeds Crown Court is because the local public in Sunderland literally hated Heron, and that meant that it was unlikely he'd receive a fair trial if it was done in that area, so that's why they moved it to Leeds. However, I will tell you that the community weren't just going to let him get off by having it at Leeds without them making it clear how they felt disdain-wise towards him. So loads of people from the local area, including Nicky's extended family, travelled daily to be at the trial, and this demonstrates the level of commitment that the community and certainly Nicky's family had to this case. When I say Nicky's family never let go of seeking justice for their little girl, they never let go of ever letting this case go cold. And that is a powerful indicator of the feelings they had towards that child, which again is evidence of why it was so sad that they started to have negative things thrown at them about the way they were bringing up that little girl, because it is absolutely 100% clear that they devoted their life to her when she was alive, and they certainly devoted their lives to her once she had died. Now the judge in this case, when they looked at the interrogation material, they said the number of police interviews were oppressive. 7 out of the 12 tapes that were made in the interview were inadmissible. And this actually made Heron's confession inadmissible, as the evidence showed that the police had used oppressive methods to obtain a confession. So the questions themselves are very repetitive, they were very oppressive, and they basically included Heron being pounded with sexual allegations. Now, after a 6-week trial, the judge literally directed the jury to give a verdict of not guilty, which they did. So it wasn't as if the jury even had an option to say what they thought. The judge directed them and said, you have to find this person guilty. And that means that there is without doubt a hell of a lot of reasonable doubt in the case. And I would say, as far as the judge is concerned, corruption that had led to this court case being heard. Now, when that happened, Heron raised his eyes in relief, but there was fighting that broke out in the court. People were shouting out. Nicky's mother, Sharon, she passed out. Several jury members were sobbing. Bear in mind as well, Heron, who is clearly a victim in this case because he's been found not guilty by direction of the actual judge. He's already spent 13 months in custody at this point, and he's hated by everyone in his local area. And nobody believes that he's innocent either. Put that in context, because yeah, this case has been found not guilty, but the reality is people still think he is. Now, that particular case where George Herron is concerned led to changes in police interviews in the country, and it actually led to improved standards and changes of practice. So that's powerful, that it was so terrible what happened to Herron during those interrogations that it changed the face of the law and the way that interrogations were handled. But this impact on Herron's life has been catastrophic. It destroyed it. So he had his face slashed whilst he was on remand in prison. That left him scarred. He literally had to leave Sunderland and be given a new identity. Can't get worse than that, can it? That you're not even going to be who you are anymore because people want you dead. And I appreciate, by the way, why people felt that way. If you're a child killer, suspected of being that way, even if you've not been found guilty, in the minds of people around you, you're a danger. They're going to run you out of that area, whatever happens. And that's definitely what played out. But for George Herron, he's innocent. And still, he's having to have a whole new identity. He said this, moving around several times and trying to rebuild my life, what's left of it at least, hasn't been easy. Learning to trust anyone is difficult. And I haven't even felt that I could trust in any professionals to get help. That experience drove him to drink. His solicitor's office was firebombed. And at the time of Herron's acquittal, with respect, Nikki's mother Sharon believed he was responsible for Nikki's murder. And she had to live thinking that this man had got away with brutalising and murdering her child. And in 1994, Sharon actually took out civil action against Herron, which I understand. You can't find somebody guilty in the criminal courts. Maybe you can find them guilty in the civil courts. At least that's something you can say to people. Well, this person says he did it. So she sued him for damages for battery of a child, resulting in her death. The case, it wasn't actually contested by Herron, and that meant that Sharon, by default, won. The court then awarded Sharon £7,000, but she didn't actually receive any money because Herron could not be traced, because Herron was living under a new identity, of course. Now, she said after the acquittal that she was literally accused of being a bad mother, and that she felt that everyone was angry at her rather than Nikki's killer. And I guess that comes down to the fact that people didn't have somebody to blame. And when it comes down to child murder, we want to be able to blame somebody. We want to be able to say that's their fault. It makes sense that they're the reason this happened, and it makes us feel safe. But for Nikki's mother, it's brutal, and it impacted on her physical health, impacted on her mental health. She even ended up getting sectioned, God bless her. So it just destroyed her. And bear in mind, you're already destroyed by the loss of the child that you love and the knowledge in which that child died. It must have been catastrophic on every level. But what's really chilling is that Nikki's true killer, well, they escaped justice for over 30 years. We are talking about a child sexual predator and murderer of the highest level, walking the streets. But Nikki's mother never stopped campaigning for justice. And you see, that's the key here. That woman that people levied blame at, that woman that criticised her, that threw sticks and stones of blame consistently at her, well, as much as she was wounded, as much as she experienced mental decline, she never stopped seeking the justice that her little girl deserved. And she did not give up. And that's amazing. In spite of everything she went through, she was like a dog with a bone. And when I say that, I mean a Rottweiler. In February 2014, Sunderland serial killer Stephen Grierson, he was arrested on suspicion of Nikki's murder. And Sharon actually wrote to him begging him to cooperate. Anyway, he was questioned and he was bailed. Then he had his bail cancelled. And then the police actually said that he would face no further action. Sharon, at this point, gets arrested herself for challenging people that she believed could be covering for others, because she's desperate, so she's probably not acting in a way that is charming. Maybe she is being a little bit harassing, but we have to remember what this is for Sharon. Her daughter was murdered and brutalized in the most horrific of ways, and she's had to live with that nightmare every waking moment from that moment of loss. So she probably does do things that, shall we say, involve taking the law into her own hands. But you know what? I'm a mother. And you bet your bottom dollar, if somebody stole my babies, I would go to the ends of the earth until I had got my justice. And if no one else gave me that justice, then maybe I would seek my own personal vengeance. So I empathize with her, and I'm sure so many of you do. Her mother never gave up hope. Nikki's mum consistently pushed forward, desperate to find Nikki's killer. She spoke out about how the police had let her down. She said she was treated like a drunken mother with a mental health problem. She actually launched a petition in 2016. That petition gained more than 500 signatures in less than 24 hours, asking for police to carry out a review of the case. And in 2017, thank God, she got the backing from the Chief Constable of Northumbria Police for a fresh inquiry. The new inquiry began in 2017. It was long, it was complex, and it was a painstaking investigation. And for all the failures in the past where the police are concerned, we have to give them credit for reopening this one. And they looked at the whole case from the beginning. The police took 1,200 statements, looked at 2,500 documents, and of course, there's been a big change. Forensic science has moved on drastically. So by 2017, there were new technologies, and that meant that the police were able to look at DNA evidence, and that's something that warms my heart, because there are these perpetrators, there are these killers, rapists, child molesters, and so on and so forth, who back when they committed the crime, got away with it. Because we didn't have the technologies that allow us to look as deeply as we do now to connect the pieces of the puzzle, to find that missing puzzle piece. And now, those perpetrators who have been walking free, who've been thinking that they got away with it, it's just a matter of time. They are prisoners walking. They just don't know it yet. So the police looked at DNA traces on Nikki's clothing, and they recovered YSTR DNA from an unknown male. So now they have a chance. Now they have an opportunity to potentially find the true perpetrator. So the police start a new appeal, and they appeal for anyone who encountered Nikki before she went missing to come forward to give their DNA sample so that they can basically be ruled out. Now, more than 800 men in Sunderland volunteered to do that. That just shows you, doesn't it, the desire, the desperation even, in the community and the willingness of that community. And let me tell you, when this case is concerned, I cannot impress on you or express to you the level of commitment of the people of Sunderland. They have rallied round to bring this perpetrator to justice. And they even, when in 2017 these inquiries were reignited, invested their time as they had back in the day when it first occurred. They were so connected to finding justice for Nikki. So those 800 men give the DNA in. And what follows is a very complex investigation. Police looked at 1,000 potential suspects and actually ruled out all of them but one, because they did find DNA evidence that linked a man called David Boyd to the body of Nikki Allen. So this DNA evidence was found in 4 places on Nikki's clothing. So at the time, David Boyd was a 54-year-old man living in Stockton on Tees. But at the time of Nikki's murder, he was a 25-year-old man. He was Nikki's neighbour. He lived just 3 doors down from Nikki's grandparents. He was also the boyfriend of a woman who actually babysat Nikki. And he had 22 convictions and 45 offences, including sexual crimes. So in 1997, all the way back then, he admitted to police that he had exposed himself to 3 teenage girls. He wasn't charged for this. Excuse me? He wasn't charged for this? He literally indecently exposed himself on a school field. He also tried to kiss a girl who didn't want his advances, but he didn't get a charge in spite of admitting it. This is a high-level predatory sexual offence. he didn't get charged. How abandoning of responsibility are the authorities in that moment? He faced no charges. He wasn't convicted of any offence, despite the admissions that he made. Boyd also confessed that he'd exposed himself on other occasions, been taking drinking drugs, and didn't necessarily know why he acted that way, but was clearly somebody who was a growing sexual predator. He also had a conviction for indecent exposure and indecent assault in 1999 because he'd indecently assaulted a 9-year-old girl at a park in Stockton Teesside. Can you believe what a predator this man is? He approached the victim, he approached her and a friend, both of whom he didn't know. He asked what they were doing, then he asked the victim if she had any knickers on, and then he sexually assaulted her when she didn't answer. The girls, thank God, ran away, and Boyd was picked out in an identity procedure and later convicted of indecent assault. In 2000, Boyd actually told a doctor that he had feelings of guilt and shame about his behaviour. He said that he'd been depressed and drunk and acted on impulse. And he later told a probation officer that he had dirty thoughts about the victim and begun to feel excited about the thought of touching the girls. Boyd said that that did lead to shame and guilt afterwards, but he liked to blame alcohol for leading him to behave like that, which is sidestepping accountability and responsibility. It's all very well saying, I was drunk, that's why I did it. Listen, we all get drunk. Sometimes, very occasionally, we get drunk to a position in a place that we're not proud of. I apparently once tried to escape from a very small window when I was intoxicated. It led to me never drinking spirits again. It happens. But at no point was I in a position where I suddenly became a sexual predator. That's not what happens. If you're a sexual predator though, and it lowers your inhibitions, you might act on the impulses, but it's the fact you're a sexual predator that's the issue. And the fact that he's not taking responsibility and accountability because he can blame the alcohol, that says he's not going to change his behavior. Because you can always blame something, can't you, for your behavior. He also admitted to a probation officer that when he was just 22 years old, so that's just 3 years before he killed Nikki, that he began to fantasize about children, particularly young girls. He confessed that he would think about young girls being naked and what it would be like to touch their body and have sexual intercourse with them. At that point, is it possible for the probation officer to get out of a drawer some kind of equipment that will mean that person has, I don't know, a massive pee burnt onto their head and can stop their hands working ever again? I'm just throwing it out there. I know it seems like an extreme method, but ultimately that feels like a way of telling the general public that somebody is a danger whilst also incapacitating their opportunity to molest the child. I'm not saying it's gonna fly. I'm not saying that the judiciary are going to think that Queen Emma of the law is going to be the right person to do this. I'm just saying that in my fantasy, at the point where he says that to the probation officer and that he's got this previous form, we should probably ensure that he can't harm any other children. Is that so weird to expect? I worry deeply about child sexual predators in our community. I don't think you can heal them for the most part. And when you're at such a high level that Boyd is acting at, this man needs to be off the streets. So Boyd's name had actually been given to detectives at the time of the murder, but he'd given a false alibi when he was questioned. And allegedly and apparently that was enough. So the very fact that he admits that he had indeed seen Nikki and he'd watched her playing, and therefore, he's in the line of fire as far as I'm concerned, as a suspect. But he added to that, that it couldn't have been him because he went for some fish and chips. I kid you not. But what we know about a lot of guilty parties is that they will put themselves to some degree in the position of having some kind of contact with a victim or seeing a victim because they believe that that kind of exonerates them from being considered guilty. Because why would I even implicate myself in any way, shape or form? If I was truly guilty, I must be innocent. That's why I'm saying that I did actually see the victim. But actually in reality, it's usually because they saw the victim because they were making that person their victim. But all this person needed to say was, I was at the fish and chip shop, and apparently that's enough of an alibi to make the person go, well, it can't be him. Said he saw the little girl playing, but he went for chips, so as we know. If you're going to go and have a fish and chips on a night, you could never be considered a murderer because people who eat fish and chips don't kill people. That's the logic clearly the officer was using when they came to that conclusion. So he was basically regarded, I kid you not, by police as a helpful neighbour rather than a suspect. Unbelievable. And it feels genuinely that the police were so hot on Heron as a suspect, as the guilty party, that they didn't even consider Boyd as a suspect. Now, that's a big problem. It's 3 decades of a problem as far as I'm concerned, as well as 3 decades of agony for Nicky's family. So there are various factors pointing to Boyd as the perpetrator. So the DNA evidence, I know that's newer and therefore it wasn't there at the time of the crime, but that's a strong link. And just to put this into context, so this particular DNA is YSTR, and essentially that's not the same definitive DNA links that we'd see in certain cases where it's like a trillion to one or whatever. This is more to do with there being a male relative connection. So it could be that Boyd had been the killer or a male relative of Boyd had been the killer. And actually it is prevalent in around 1 in 28,000 men, this same particular DNA. However, then you have to say, well, it would have to be likely a male relative of Boyd's. They'd have to be in the area at the time. They'd have to be an individual who knew Nicky because she went off with that person. They'd have to therefore be in the area local to Nicky. They wouldn't have to be seen by anybody because otherwise they'd be noted as a potential suspect. And the list goes on, reducing the possibility of anybody else being implicated in the crime aside from Boyd. Also, just going to throw it out there, probably the most obvious thing for the time, Boyd had a striking resemblance to the man that was last seen with Nicky before her disappearance. Shouldn't that have been probably one of the most obvious reasons why they should have investigated him further? Literally looks like the e-fit that they created of him. People thought that the way that he looked was also the way that the potential perpetrator looked. So why they just saw him as a helpful neighbour, I've got no idea whatsoever. They were so fixated on bringing Heron to justice that they just locked in and then ignored all the other really important evidence. He fits the profile as well because they believed that this perpetrator who killed Nicky would be somebody that she knew and he knew her. He also knew the murder site well. He'd been to the exchange building literally the week before the murder with a teenager who was looking for pigeons. And he even was able to describe to the police after he was arrested which entrance he used when he went on that visit. It was the same entrance that Nicky's killer used. And bear in mind, the actual building that Nicky was taken to, it was pitch black. There was so little light penetrating that you would have to know the building to actually be able to enter it in the way he did and to perpetrate the crime which he carried out. And so again, if it was a random stranger who was just related to the DNA because it's 1 in 28,000, it would have to be somebody who knew that building. So that brings it back down statistically to it could only be Boyd. So Boyd gets arrested for Nicky's murder in April 2018. This is at his home in Stockton. Immediately, he denies it. Of course he did.
Yeah, I owe you. No, no, from the police, come over.
Yeah.
Cheers. Do us a favour and just knock the telly off for a second. Pardon? Can you do us a favour and just knock the telly off just so you can hear what I'm saying? Thanks, yeah. Good. This, I'm Terry. This is Marty. We're part of the team that's reinvestigating the murder of Nicky Allen.
Yeah.
Okay. Part of that investigation has led us to suspect that you may have had some involvement in that. Okay. I'm arresting you on suspicion, okay, of that offence. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your offence if you do not mention, when questioned, something which you later align in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. Just leave your phone there for a moment.
Wasn't me. Got away with it for over 30 years. May as well try and get away with it for even longer. Neighbours said that officers turned up to his residence at 8 a.m. and then following Boyd's arrest, they have a warrant to search his house. And witnesses who watched that play out said that forensic officers in white suits spent around 8 hours coming in and out of the house. And they were said to have brought out a number of full clear plastic bags. But it's 4 years before the police had a case strong enough to actually bring before the courts. That's 4 more years of freedom because they didn't have enough to remand him. So we're talking about a potential child murderer, sexual predator, being free to walk the streets in spite of the profound damage that he had potentially to do to society and the profound damage he'd already carried out towards Nicky's family. It's absolutely terrifying when you think about it in that context. The idea that this man has been free for decades and yet his behaviour has clearly been so dangerous. We've seen that in the prior crimes that he committed and in the crime that I'm covering today. He is a child sexual predator. And at this point, when he's still walking the streets, a suspected child killer. And how that must be for Nicky's family as well. The idea that this man is still walking the streets, really? Even though their gorgeous little girl was stolen? So the court case against Boyd is tried at Newcastle Crown Court in 2023. It's tried by jury. Boyd refused to give evidence in the witness box. Of course he did, because under cross-examination, he would have had a new arsehole tore. It's as simple as that. But of course he denies murder and he pleads not guilty. And as we all know, a really innocent person is the kind of person who will say they're not going to give any evidence. I mean, if you have nothing to hide, then speak freely. You can't trip yourself up when you're innocent. It's as simple as that. And actually,
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
Stories are really effective on the whole at being able to discern somebody who's lying or not lying. So this is your opportunity to stake your claim for your freedom. But no, he just says, I'm not guilty and I'm not going to talk about it. The prosecution, they say that as far as they are concerned, and I would fully agree with them, Boyd had the intention of committing a sexual offence against Nicky. But they say also that after she resisted and screamed, that's when he brutally murdered her. I feel that he was always going to murder her. He lures her away. He didn't need to take her to that building to sexually molest her. There would have been plenty of opportunities to do that to her. In fact, it would have been far more in line with what we'd expect to see with a paedophile to build a relationship with Nicky. She was somebody he had access to through his girlfriend. The girlfriend babysat for Nicky's family. So the mindset of a predator is to create an alliance with the child. Then, hey, he can get his sexual kicks by building a relationship with her, coercing her into a belief that he cares for her, and then molesting her in a way that we see perpetrators molest children that they have access to. Why would he take her to an abandoned, dark building? Why would you take her somewhere that it would be difficult to hear her screams? He took her there to kill her. And I know that I've not worked on the case. And I know that people can form the stories that they believe are realistic for how the crime played out. But for me, he stabbed her so many times, he annihilated her life. You don't escalate from just wanting to have some kind of sexual connection with a child to murdering them so brutally because the child screams. He took her there so that he could get away with murder after violating her. And I'll stand by that till the end of time. The prosecution said that Nicky was lured to the building by someone she knew for a sinister purpose. They argued there was a sexual component to the murder. Without a doubt, there was. They also said that Nicky had been dumped like a sack of rubbish, and she was. They stressed that Nicky would have been absolutely terrified in the moments before her death. In fact, in the judge's summing up, the judge relates to the fact that he knew how to push her through the small gap that would get her into the abandoned building. It would have been pitch black. She would have had no idea where she was, but she would have known he was coming for her, and she ran. Because it's likely that she got to almost the other side of the building because they found blood and evidence that she had been attacked there. So she had tried to escape in that dark, running from this bastard. That's how she ended her life. So no, I don't buy into this idea that he had taken her there to sexually molest her, because predators are clever and they know how to do that far more effectively. He took her there to bring terror to her final moments. He took her there to destroy that little girl's life in the most macabre and malevolent way possible, and he did it. And then he did just discard her like rubbish. The prosecution said to the jury, you can be sure that Boyd is the killer. They said if Boyd wasn't the killer, then Nikki would have had to have been murdered by a phantom or an invisible man who left behind not a scientific trace, not a shred of evidence. Jurors were shown pictures of the murder scene. They saw a heavily bloodstained floor and wall, and they could also see drag marks leading to her body. Jurors were also very fortunately informed of Boyd's clearly sexually predatory past. He was a sex offender who'd fantasized about young girls. He shouldn't have been walking our streets. Now, to try to explain the DNA evidence, Boyd had actually come up with this cock and bull story that on the night that Nikki had been killed, he'd spat off a balcony, and that must have hit Nikki. Honestly, the police should just have like a wet fish that can slap around the face of these individuals when they make up such bollocks. So can you explain to us why your DNA evidence is on the body of the child that was found in separate places? Yeah, I can. I was on my balcony and I decided that I had a bit of a chesty cough, a bit of catarrh, so I needed to loosen it up, so I did. And then when it came into my mouth, I spat it out. And by some weird coincidence, it landed on her. And that's how I got my DNA. Weren't you saying that you literally saw the girl playing and you were going for fish and chips at the time? Yeah, I got a sausage as well. How did you get from the balcony to the chip shop while seeing the girl playing, whilst apparently spitting on her from a balcony, which arguably if you had done, she probably wouldn't be playing because she'd be dealing with your grotesque fluids all over her. Sorry, I'm thinking about the sausage that I bought that night. I don't remember anything else. Just accept that I grollied over the balcony. And that's a perfect description. Did you just hit me with a wet fish? Yes, sir. I did. A large wet fish. Again, sorry, went into a bit of a fantasy there about how these things should play out. But that's his excuse. This is how he's suggesting the DNA evidence has turned up. And to explain the DNA under her coat, I kid you not, he says, well, Nikki may have wiped her hand in his spit and smeared it on her clothes. Because it's what you do. You know, you get spat on. Any child would do the same, wouldn't it? Get it on your neck and you're like, oh no, what shall I do with this? I know, I'll open my coat and I'll smear it on my clothes. You might smear it on the outside, not the inside, sweetheart. But he's thinking ahead of this because he knows he's banged to rights. These are unbelievable explanations. In fact, it would have been far better for Boyd to have gone, I've got no bloody idea. Absolutely no idea. I have no reason why my DNA would be anywhere near that girl. That actually seems a lot less incriminating than this ridiculous story he comes up with. But this is a child murderer. They're liars. And the only people they care about is themselves. Now, Boyd's defense team, they said that the evidence did not prove that Boyd had killed Nikki. They said that it was the result of innocent coincidences. Just those innocent coincidences. You know, the innocent coincidences that incriminate guilty people. All those innocent coincidences. So they said that that many people would basically match the description of the man last seen with Nikki. Yes, that's correct, they would, including Boyd, who strikingly looks like the guy who killed her. And by the way, it's Boyd who knew the building and knew the entrance to the building, the same entrance that Nikki was pushed through. And it's Boyd who happened to have a relationship with her to some degree because of the babysitting and living three doors down from the grandparents. Oh, and it's Boyd who did apparently see her on the night that she disappeared when he was going apparently for fish and chips. Oh, and it's Boyd whose DNA evidence has turned up on the child's clothing. And it's Boyd who came up with a false alibi. But all of these are just innocent coincidences. Is it also innocent that he actually was guilty of being a child predator? Oh, that's not an innocent coincidence. That's a guilty coincidence. It was still a coincidence. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You can imagine that the jury were really buying into that, weren't they? Now, in the direction of the judge to the jury, the judge said that the evidence against Boyd was circumstantial and that there was no direct evidence, although all that did feel pretty direct. Particularly the bit about him being a child sexual predator and his DNA, albeit it could be familial DNA and albeit it could be 1 in 28,000 other men's DNA, but, you know, it's pretty compelling, isn't it? Apart from that evidence not being apparently direct evidence, what she did say, and she's one stern judge, let me tell you, when I watched those summing up of what she said, you can tell she 100% knows he's guilty. So she said that looking at the evidence together leaves no doubt that the defendant is guilty. And the judge also, with respect, urged jurors to set aside any perfectly normal human feelings of sympathy towards Nikki's family from impacting their judgment and verdict. When the jury came back, yeah, he was convicted of Nikki's murder and found guilty, thank God, in May 2023. It's way too late for the family as far as they're concerned, because that's 3 decades of him being free and 3 decades of him being able to do unspeakable things to other children. But at least they got their man. That jury took just 2.5 hours of deliberation. And as the verdict was read out, it was met with cheers and cries of thank you by the public gallery. Police officers actually had to be brought into court to restore order. And as all this just played out in Technicolor and people were just so moved with the emotion of finally having this man brought to justice, Boyd did not even react. There was no physical movement or emotional movement from him. David Boyd was sentenced on the 23rd of May 2023, and during Boyd's sentencing, a timeline was put together of what happened on the night of the 7th of October 1992. So this is how they believe it played out, that Nikki trotted behind Mr. Boyd and he led her to the old exchange building. That's where Boyd attempted to, or did in fact sexually assault Nikki. They believe that she screamed around 10 p.m. At this point, Boyd struck Nikki in the face, causing her lip to bleed to shut her up. There was then some struggle because this little girl fought for her life. And that's why Nikki's shoes and her coat came off. And then they think that after the scream, Boyd decided that he needed to silence her to stop her from telling anyone what he'd done. At this point, he hoisted Nikki up, pushed her through a window into the exchange building, and Nikki would have been terrified, petrified in the dark building. They say that she ran as far away as she could and that Boyd caught her, struck her in the head with a brick, and then he stabbed her in a frenzied attack. After Nikki had been killed, Boyd dragged her by her ankles to the basement, left her in a far corner, just hoping that her body would be undiscovered. But he was so far off dealing with reality. Because, yeah, he may be someone that nobody would care about if he should disappear. He's just a stain on our society. But Nikki was adored. Her mother would go to the ends of the earth to bring her home. And when she couldn't bring her home, then she would go to the ends of the earth to find her killer. When questioned by police, of course, we also know he told the police that he was getting fish and chips. That was between 9:30 p.m. and 10 p.m. This provided a false alibi, and that therefore allowed him to get away with murder until the DNA evidence caught him. When it came down to Boyd's mitigation for his sentencing, his defence team said that mental subnormality should be considered. Now, to put that in context, it means that because he was somebody who had a mental illness and he also had learning difficulties, so he had an IQ that was in the bottom 2% of the population, that somehow that should be a mitigating factor, which would seemingly suggest that if you're an individual who decides that you are going to horrifically murder, violate, abuse, and so on and so forth, anybody, that apparently if you're not the brightest person on an academic level, IQ level, then you should be given some kind of a special license. And that is actually really insulting for people who don't score high on IQs, because we all know that just because your IQ isn't huge doesn't mean that firstly you're a predator of the highest level, but secondly that you don't understand morality. Of course you do, but this is probably the defense scrabbling for some kind of mitigation. And as we know, screw the idea that mental illness makes you one of these kind of sexual predatory killers. It doesn't. There's no evidence whatsoever that that would be the case. And the judge fortunately agrees with that. The judge said that any intellectual difficulties you face do not affect your culpability for this offense. So it's dismissed, as Boyd certainly had the ability to lure Nikki away from her home and also come up with a false alibi when questioned by the police, which is really manipulative. So that doesn't sound like somebody who struggles with their IQ. You can create a complete falsehood to try and get yourself off the hook, and then you can be deeply manipulative and make it so that the police believe that you weren't the person because you were getting fish and chips. And also, when you're culpable of being able to coerce a child into going off with you, well, that seems like somebody is functioning at a pretty high level in many different ways, at least on a malevolent level. The judge also said that this crime would horrify all those who hear and read about it. And I think we can all agree, you've listened to what I've told you today. Certainly, that is the case. Now, David Boyd was sentenced and must serve at least 29 years, which was the life sentence that you could get in 1992 for the crime. And this is something I really struggle with. Because the offence was committed in 1992, Boyd had to be sentenced in relation to the law then. Now, I get it. In the UK, we are traditionally a very legal judicial system and we stick to the typology and the organisation of the law to the letter on the whole. And basically, because in 1992 sentences were shorter, it means that because the crime was committed there, he gets that applied to his sentence. I mean, forget the 30 years he's had free walking around. Apparently, that doesn't give him any additional years, which I would think it should, because this guy didn't take any responsibility, carried out the most horrific murder, carried out other awful crimes, and has had freedom all this time, but somehow he benefits from the fact that he did it in 1992. So he gets a lesser sentence. So if he'd done it today, so if it was a modern day case.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Essentially, the minimum sentence would have been 37 years. Unbelievable. The judge actually told Boyd whilst giving the sentence, "You decided to kill her to silence her and to prevent her from telling anyone that you had sexually assaulted her or had attempted to do so." Now, like I said, I think they're powerful statements from the judge, but I don't believe that he did it because he was attempting to quieten her down. I think he did it because he wanted to murder a child. You don't stab a kid 37 times because you're trying to silence them. You're doing it because you want to execute and decimate them. The judge also said that there's no guarantee that Boyd would be released from prison and it would be up to the parole board to decide. Good, because that guy killed a little 7-year-old girl. And also, I'm just going to throw in a little bit more key information that makes me believe that he always planned to murder her, that he was interested in child killing, not in child molestation. He had a knife. Why would you have a knife with you? It's not hard to overpower a 7-year-old. You don't need to threaten them with a knife. No. I stand by what I'm saying. This was a man who intended to kill a child, and he did. Now, Nikki's mother, Sharon, she slammed Boyd's sentence as a disgrace and an injustice. She said, "I'm absolutely devastated at the sentence, absolutely devastated." And she thinks that Boyd should have been given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. And I 100% agree with Sharon. Like I said, this guy has had freedom for a very long time. He's been able to walk the streets and do probably irreparable damage to other people's lives. Why should he ever take a breath of freedom again? Now, after the trial, Sharon spoke of the injustice. She said, "This evil man slipped through the net to murder Nikki when he was on their files in the first place." Sharon's also claimed that she's yet to receive a direct apology from the police force. She says she only knew about the apology from the media. And that is cold, you know. Sit down with the family, say sorry, take responsibility. We need you to do that as an authority. If the police fail to do those things, it means that it breaks down trust, and that's wrong, and they should have apologised directly to Nikki's family. Police told the BBC that they had been unable to contact her and that they'd made multiple attempts, which is a little bit weird because, I don't know about you, it's pretty easy these days on social media to get in touch with anyone, even A-list celebrities. Now, she said that she would prefer to see action rather than words. And when you've lost a child this way, I would concur that that would be your feeling. She also believes that there are others involved in Nikki's murder who should be investigated by the police, but police are certain that Boyd acted alone. That said, I'm sure that she won't have a lot of faith in that because of the fact that they made so many mistakes leading to this point. They also said that they would share information with Sharon to reassure her that this was the case. So they're saying there'll be some transparency there should she seek it. Nikki's mother, Sharon's, also called for a public inquiry into Northumbria's police's historic failures in Nikki's case. And she's actually been backed by the Legal Charity Centre for Women's Justice. So hopefully she will get some kind of investigation that will give her the answers that she desires. And Nikki has said that she's been asking questions about Boyd over and over again before he was arrested, but to no avail. She said that Boyd should have been in the police's sights immediately. I would agree with that. Clearly, there were lots of indicators that should have placed him at least into further investigation. Now, after Boyd's conviction, the police have bothered to write a formal apology to Heron for the false accusation that ruined his life. The Assistant Chief Constable of Northumbria Police, Alistair Simpson, wrote in a letter that he would like to apologise for the mistakes made in the investigation and hope that Boyd's conviction would finally bring some closure and allow Heron to move on with life. Well, I think you'll find that he had to change his identity and was chased out of his local area and people wanted him dead. His solicitors literally got firebombed. I'm imagining the apology isn't really going to cut it. So in a substantial statement that he released, he said, "Nikki's murder destroyed so many people's lives and I am just one of these people." He said, "I lost what little honour and property I had as a result of being falsely accused of Nikki Allen's murder. I've had to read and hear both online and offline malicious lies being spread about me and my family, some of whom are now deceased and whose funerals I didn't get a chance to attend as I didn't even find out about their deaths until months later. When I was arrested and interviewed in October 1992, my DNA was taken and has been on record since then. The police would have been able to check it against any new developments or advances in science. Moving around several times and trying to build what is left of my life hasn't been easy. Learning to trust anyone is difficult, and I haven't even felt that I could trust in any professionals to get help. I've had to learn how to adapt on my own. Trusting the police has taken a long time. They still make me nervous to the point of feeling nauseous if I am alone with them. I don't understand why the original officers couldn't have admitted they made a mistake, apologised and looked at the case again instead of having a blinkered view and not trying to put things right." He also added that because of the way that he was treated back then in the investigation, he ended up developing a drink issue. And he had that issue for years and he had to deal with it on his own. And he said, "I survive because I have to. Like everyone else, I would like answers as to why it took so long to find out the truth. And he finally added, finding out about the current investigation has been difficult. So many details and negative memories, bringing up mixed emotions about what happened back in 1992 and since. He said, I feel sadness, disgust, anger, betrayal by people I expected to tell the truth, especially the original investigating officers. He said, it's really difficult to put in words what I have felt since 1992, going from trying to look out for my family to having my life flipped upside down. And of course, he isn't the main victim in this, because the family of Nikki Allen have had their lives torn apart by the failures in the investigation and the loss of their gorgeous little girl. They've been unable to live a normal life after her killing. And on top of that, they were unable to receive closure because the case went unsolved for such a long time. And whilst this case is absolutely dedicated to that absolutely beautiful little girl, Nikki Allen, that gorgeous 7-year-old with so much to live for, with a love within her family that was so powerful and strong, it's also dedicated to her mother, who's shown an endless courage and an endless desire to find the justice that her daughter so desperately deserved because of her refusal to accept that this case was cold, because of her refusal to accept that no one would be brought to justice for her child's loss. She carried on fighting. People like her are warriors. And finally, she has at least some justice for her child.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.